Welcome to Episode 5 of the Harry Potter Lexicon Podcast. This is Steve Vander Ark, the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon website. And once again, we're going to spend some time together chatting about the Harry Potter canon, talking over some interesting developments, especially the fact that last night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, Pottermore opened for business, at least to some extent. And those of us that managed to chase the magic quill around actually got to sign up. Still no access to the site itself, of course. That's coming sometime over the next couple of weeks. But I know that everybody didn't make it in, especially because it was 3 o'clock in the morning. But I did, and Nick and Barbara did, and a few other people connected with the Lexicon managed to get on board. So that's exciting. So that's probably the biggest new news, even though it really still doesn't get us into the website. Looking forward to that very much. I'm not quite sure what we're going to find when we get there, but I know it'll be a lot of new canon, some new things to talk about. In the meantime, we're really not anywhere close to being done with talking about what we already have. A couple of things. I've gotten some emails, wonderful emails, people telling me how much they like the podcast, which is great. It's good to hear. There's a lot of people talking about asking why I think I have to stop at half an hour. Why don't I don't just keep going? I keep talking about having all these additional notes and things. And so I've decided today I'm not going to watch that clock quite so closely. We'll just kind of go and see what happens. I appreciate all those emails. Again, if you want to get a hold of me, if you want to chat about that kind of thing, ask some questions, make some suggestions, and so look for the links on the show notes. And also at the end of every podcast, I give some information about how to contact me and things. So by all means, let's keep the conversation going. Another email that I got one particular email that kind of sparked some thinking on my part. Somebody sent me an email with a lot of information about the sources for names of various characters and words and so on in the Harry Potter canon. And it got me thinking, asking myself the question, why a lot of that information isn't already on the Lexicon. If you've seen the book, the Lexicon book, it's all in there. I mean, I give sources for just about everything, even though some of them, honestly, even since the book was published, I've discovered new ones. It seems like there's a never-ending treasure trove of information about Harry Potter to be dug up and discovered and discussed and talked about. But the reason why is kind of interesting, and once again we have to kind of go back into the history of Harry Potter fandom and Harry Potter websites and things. Way back in 1999 and 2000, which is when this the Lexicon sort of was created and first came into being, there were the whole website. The Harry Potter website world was a little different back then. One thing that we had, there was a couple of sites which kind of became pretty popular, MuggleNet being one of them. Shortly after that was the Leaky Cauldron and the Lexicon and so. And at that time, we all sort of had a cordial relationship with each other. We all more or less knew each other, emailed back and forth and things, and we all kind of kept to our own little territories, you might say. The MuggleNet was doing a lot of the fan kinds of things. Leaky Cauldron was the place to go for Harry Potter news. It was a news blog, and really not much else. And the Lexicon was becoming the encyclopedia, the place to go for canon information. And we all sort of kept to our own territory, you might say, our own, what we were good at and what we were most interested in. And at the time, of course, obviously, we saw names like Sirius Black or Remus Lupin and immediately kind of knew where those words came from, especially those of us that had studied mythology, folklore. I was a Latin student and things like this. So a lot of these things, I right away saw the connections. But at that time, there was a website, and there still is, and it's called What's in a Name by Priscilla Spencer. And that website, she spent all of her time trying to work out the meanings of, the etymologies of, the sources of all the names and things. And the way the atmosphere was at that time is, if that's what she was doing, then I didn't want to duplicate that on the Lexicon. I didn't want people to not go to her site or not enjoy the work that she was doing because I was putting all the exact same information on my site. And that was kind of the way we all were back then. And so I didn't put that information on the lexicon, and instead I would just put links to the What's in a Name website. I'll put a link to that in the show notes if you want to go there. It hasn't been updated after book six. But even so, the work she did was great. And so at that time, that was kind of the understanding, is that the lexicon wouldn't be a replacement for her site. So then people would go to her site for that. And I realize that things have changed since then, but that was kind of why we just never put all those name meanings into the lexicon. Now, that changed somewhat when Lisa took over the character pages. And the reason she took over the character pages was she was creating a website at that time, Madame Pince's pages, which was just a character reference. And rather than me duplicating her work, I actually talked to Lisa and I said, "Hey, why don't you? Do you want to come on board with the lexicon and sort of integrate what you've done into the lexicon?" And she thought that was a great idea. So, kind of that whole philosophy, that whole sort of way we were all kind of getting along back then, is why Lisa came on board with the lexicon, and her work then became part of the lexicon. But she eventually started putting some of the name meanings for characters in there, and eventually, when I was working on what became the lexicon book, the whole goal of that book, especially particularly the second version, the one that actually was published, was to try to look for sources where everything came from, what were the sources that Rowling was using. When I do my talks about that, and we talk about, for example, centaurs. Obviously, if you know anything about mythology, and so you realize that Rowling didn't invent centaurs. She borrowed centaurs from Greek mythology. And interestingly enough, she doesn't just borrow the name centaur. She doesn't just borrow the picture of a centaur being a half-human, half-horse kind of a being, but she also borrowed the aspects of centaurs which were from mythology, by which I mean, in mythology there were two kinds of centaurs. There were the centaurs who were the wise teachers. Chiron was the teacher of Jason from Jason and the Argonauts, was this wise centaur, and the other kind of centaurs were these wild beings who there were no female centaurs, and so they would kidnap female humans you can figure out what that was for. And you'll see both of those aspects of centaurs in the Harry Potter series. You have Ferenczi, who is the wise teacher who comes in to teach divination, but then you also have centaurs like Bane and so, who end up kidnapping Umbridge. So Rowling, when she uses these sources, she borrows them deeply, you might say. She adds to the richness of her stories by looking at all of these traditions and backgrounds of things, and all these creatures that are in the books. Grindylows, for example. I mean, she didn't invent Grindylows. Those come from folklore, British folklore. And so all of these things had a source, had a place where she got them. And a lot of the words came from interesting places and so. But most of that information is not on the lexicon website. As I said, I put it into the book, but it's not on the website itself, which when I got that email, it just kind of made me think about why is it that we made that decision all those years ago to not include that information. So should that be on there now? Yeah, I think so. And if some of you may be vaguely aware of the fact that Nick Moline and his wife Barbara and I are working on sort of a I don't know if you call it a secret project, but it's still a behind-the-scenes project to upgrade the Lexicon website into something quite exciting. I'm looking forward to having people kind of see what it is we're working on. That has to kind of stay behind the scenes for right now because it's still very much in the building stages. We had quite a meeting yesterday, as a matter of fact, long meeting, sitting at an IHOP and just talking through things and planning and figuring out what was going to happen. So I'm excited about that, and you'll hear more about that as time goes along. And one of the things that we will be including is a lot of these background details and so, which are now part of my talks and are part of the lexicon book and so. So that's kind of interesting, and it's interesting also just to kind of look back at the history of Harry Potter online fandom and kind of see the way things developed and why they developed the way they did and why you now have the resources that you do at your disposal. It's exciting to be part of that, and it's fun to kind of look back and think about it. I want to talk, looking at a couple of things. As you know, I kind of go, in a sense, alphabetically. I grab the lexicon book and go to the letter B and just start looking at things and just kind of see what jogs some thoughts and some memories. And one of them that I noticed was the ancient runes teacher, which I list as Bathsheba Babbling. And the source for that, I know we talk about sources a lot, but this is an interesting source. This is actually from, not from the books, this is from some of Rowling's notes, which appeared on her website, as a matter of fact. She had a copy of one of the pages of her notes, which is a list that she had of all the teachers of the various subjects. It's not complete, but it lists their names, first and last names. It lists their gender, which was interesting because she did say at one point that she had, I believe unintentionally, but she realized that she had made it so that there was exactly six of each, six men and six women, which just kind of is an interesting note. And so this list includes Transfiguration as Minerva McGonagall, and the list is pretty much right about the time of Book 5, between books 4 and 5, I believe. And so some of these names are not correct, which brings up an interesting little problem when it comes to figuring out what's canon and what isn't. And I guess one of the reasons why some people are much more comfortable just sticking with the published novels rather than digging into this kind of thing. Because on this list, Phileas Flitwick is listed as Charms, Severus Snape is Potions, Pomona Sprout is Herbology, Remus Lupin is listed as Defense Against the Dark Arts, which is kind of how we know which book it is. And we'll talk about that more in a second. But Astronomy is Aurora Sinestra. History of Magic is Cuthbert Binns. Divination is listed as, it just says Mopsus, etc. Now, Mopsus is actually a character from, she didn't invent that name, that's a famous seer, a famous, there's a whole kind of legend about the seer Mopsus, which is an interesting little story in itself, but she just lists that Mopsus, etc., no first name, and the etc. kind of shows that she wasn't exactly sure what name she was going to use. The fact that there was a divination professor, obviously, in Book 3 named Trelawney shows you that I just said this was Book 4 or 5. You know, that may have been, now that I think about it, that probably means that this was actually in the planning for Book 3, because that name was settled on in Book 3. But then the study of ancient runes is Bathsheba Babbling. That's Bathsheda. Now, so, we've kind of debated whether she means Bathsheba, which is an actual name, biblical in this case, but it's definitely a D, Bathsheda, babbling. And babbling, of course, means to blather on about meaningless stuff, which kind of fits in, I guess, with ancient runes in a typically rolling sort of humorous way. Arithmancy is Septima Vector. Care of Magical Creatures is Rubaeus Hagrid. And there's nobody listed for Muggle Studies, but it is listed as being female. So that we don't find out actually who the Muggle Studies professor was until Book 7. So anyway, that's just an interesting list, whether or not you can consider this to be canon or not. Since it isn't all correct, she lists down at the bottom, there's a numbered list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where she's putting in the names of the Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers year by year, first year being Quirrell, second year Lockhart, third year Lupin, fourth year she lists Pettigrew. Now that is interesting, because if at one point her plan was to have Peter Pettigrew be the fourth year Goblet of Fire era Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, we can see where her planning, her story changed in Book 3 to the point where that no longer worked, and she had to come up with the character of Moody. But think about it, Moody was pretending to be someone else. Pettigrew was pretending to be someone else. It raises all sorts of interesting questions we could talk about in terms of what her plans were. What were her plot plans for those books? Especially when we know that she said that in the writing of Book 4 she ran into the realization that she'd made a big blunder or error in her planning and her plotting, and she had to do big changes in Book 4 as a result, which, again, may tie into the fact that at one point she was planning on Pettigrew being the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher in Book 4. And then book five is listed as, it says, Mylor, and the name above is written Mylor Sylvanus, S-I-L-V-A-N-U-S. And then another possibility is listed as Oakden Hobday, H-O-B-D-A-Y. So, yeah, it's just interesting to see these kinds of notes. And if you aren't sure how to get this particular page and have a look at it yourself, the lexicon does have instructions for how to go to the Rowling's page and actually do the little things you need to do in order to get this page. And it's well worth a look. I'll put a link in the show notes to where we list the steps you have to go through to get this little special bit on the site. So just interesting to see where that particular name came from. And again, that puts us right back in that place of what is canon, what isn't canon, how accurate can we consider this list, because we want to have Cuthbert as the first name for Binns and Aurora as the first name for Sinistra, and we want to have these things from this list. But if we have that, but then we take other things on the list and say, yeah, but we're not going to count this because it obviously changed. So how accurate is this list? And it's an interesting question, and one that we keep debating about. I know that on the lexicon, if it hasn't specifically been changed and it's on this list, we kind of consider that to be canon. Another thing in the letter B, this is just one of those lovely little details. Beatrix Bloxham, who is one of the famous wizard cards, originally her birth and death date made her about 16 years old when she died. It said that she died in 1810, which didn't even really think about, except for the as time went by, Beatrix Bloxham was developed out in especially in Tales of Beetle the Bard as being this person who had quite a history of writing these kind of silly, fluffy little kid-friendly, and that's in massive air quotes, kid-friendly stories, which were some quite often derived from the original Tales of Beetle the Bard. In that book, in Tales of Beetle the Bard, the published book, her death date was changed to 1910. So that's just one of these little things where, again, we're talking about canon. What is canon? What isn't? Where do the edits and the fixes come in? And this is a case, obviously, where the change in date in Tales of Beetle the Bard makes it make a lot more sense. Can't slip past the letter B without talking about the borough. If you've been to any of my talks, when I talk about some of the geography, the places in the Harry Potter universe, the borough is one that I focus on a lot, because the borough is an actual real place. The story of how I found it, and let me go back to, well, 2003. This is when Nimbus, the very first Harry Potter convention. I, with Penny Linsenmeyer, she and I decided we were going to do a talk on the geography of Harry Potter. And she focused more on the places where Rowling herself had grown up and things. And it's funny because so much of that is kind of common knowledge in fandom now. But at the time, we had to do some digging to find this stuff. We put this presentation together. And one of my part of it was I was going to try to find the fictional places, kind of get as close to them as I could and figure out where they would be. One of the places I wanted to find was the Burrow. And so I did a lot of searching to try to find Ottery St. Catchpole, which is the place that we do know that the borough is near. And there is no town called Ottery St. Catchpole in Britain, but there is a town called Ottery St. Mary. And the Ottery part means that that town is located on the River Otter, which is in the West Country right near Exeter. Now, it's interesting, if you look at a map of Britain, and you look at a map of the West Country, and you look around Exeter, you're going to find a number of Harry Potter-connected names. Dawlish is a town on the coast, which is near Exeter. Dawlish, of course, turned into the Auror, John Dawlish. And by the way, John, it came from, he's named after John Noe of the Leaky Cauldron's Pottercast, which is really cool. He is has every right to be very proud of the fact that he has a Harry Potter character actually named after him. But if you look around, you're going to find, of course, Ottery St. Mary, which is located relatively close to Exeter, within maybe 10, 15 miles. And so I looked at Ottery St. Mary as being the perhaps the model for Ottery St. Catchpole. And now the name has changed, but then again, near there also is the town of Chudley, Or Chudley Cannons, of course, but it's spelled differently. There's also Budley Salterton, which is turned into Budley Babberton in Book 6. So you have these names which she did change, and so, again, Ottery St. Mary could have been changed to Ottery St. Catchpole. Now, just to show, I actually wrote the book that I wrote In Search of Harry Potter kind of documents my travels as I do this and shows all these places that I found. And so the full story of kind of how this all came to be is in that book. And I'm not going to tell the whole tale right now, but basically I looked at Goblet of Fire when Harry and everybody else got up early and they walked from the borough through town to Stoatshead Hill to catch the portkey. And one of the sentences in there says that the sun was coming up to their right. So if that's the case, that means that the borough must be south of Ottery St. Catchpole or Ottery St. Mary in order for the sun to be rising on their right as they were walking from the borough to through the town. So yeah, we get that I get that picky in order to find these things. And so I actually had a rental car. I drove south out of Ottery St. Mary, which is its own delightful story of that town and some of the interesting background stuff about that. And I drove south, and you have to, if you've not been to that part of Britain, you have to kind of drive through there to kind of get a sense of what I mean. I'll put a picture on the show notes to kind of show you the way that this looks. I mean, there are hedgerows along the roads. You don't have most places you don't have a clear view of the countryside around you, and you get a real sense of the fact that just about anything could be hidden in and amongst these rolling hills. And I often think about, why did Rowling set so much of her stories in the West Country? Well, if you think about what that looks like and what it's like there, you get a real sense of the fact that this is a place where there could be some magical place hidden away just on the other side of all these hedgerows and things. And I was driving south, and only went about a mile, and was trying to kind of get south and a little bit east to try to get into the area where I thought the borough should be. And I took a left-hand turn down this little, tiny little country lane, hedgerows on either side, and I came over a hill and stopped the car up short because in front of me was a signpost, honest to goodness, that said borough. 1/4 mile with an arrow pointing down this even smaller little two-track lane into the countryside, and I just sort of stared at this thing. You can imagine I climbed out of the car and just kind of stood there, absolutely flabbergasted, looking at this sign that said the borough. And of course, obviously, I had to go down there. It was so narrow that I really wasn't sure I'd be able to turn around once I drove down this little thing, but obviously I had to go. And strangely enough, my GPS stopped working right about then as well, which in retrospect is sort of telling. And I went down this little path, this little lane, and sure enough, there is a little farm called the Borough Hill Farm, which is located right exactly where it would logically be according to the books, and there is the Borough Hill Farm. And there's a whole story again about what happened when I got there, some of those details. If you're really interested, if you want to kind of read the whole thing, see if you can get a copy of that book, because I kind of do it in a travel memoir style. I just kind of tell the whole tale, and amazing to come across this, and it's very old. It's not like a modern farm. It's very, you know, whitewashed walls and things like this. And I'll see if I can rustle up one of the pictures that I took and put that on the show notes as well, so you can see what the actual borough looks like. Now, was this the model for the borough? It certainly seems awfully coincidental that it'd be in the same exact place and have the, you know, everything about it. I don't know. I mean, I have no way of knowing if Rowling was ever aware of this. She did go to university 15 miles away, and it's certainly possible that she saw it at some point, either drove past it or heard about it or saw it on a map or whatever. But there really is a borough, and just an amazing thing to stand there in kind of looking at this little farm and realizing that I was that close to the Weasleys' magical house there in the West Country. So, looking at the letter B, there's a lot more, of course. So we'll just kind of set that aside for now and maybe spend a little more time talking about some other things next time in that letter B. But I do want to move on. I've been kind of thinking about this and talked, I think I've mentioned this in a couple of previous podcasts, just the idea that when we look at the Harry Potter series, we're kind of trained, especially with the films, to think of each story as being its own little self-contained tale, almost like an episode of a sitcom where the episodes really don't have a lot of connection to each other. And we do know, of course, that it's not that they do connect to each other, but we tend to think of them that way, especially when people will say, oh, what's your favorite film or what's your favorite book? And we do separate it. We break it into pieces in our minds. And that's inevitable. But the interesting thing, remember that Rowling did plan these out as one big, long tale, one saga, broken up, of course, by school year. So it had this natural division built into it, but that the story itself sweeps over this 7 or 8 years of Harry's life, and it is one tale. We have these characters that develop through these stories, that change through these stories. And speaking again, we step into or out of the story. Stepping out of it now, we can look at this can go back to the email that I got, someone asking me why Rowling wrote the character of Luna into the film, which of course, again, she wrote Luna into the book, but why does the character of Luna appear in book 5? And you can say, well, because, you know, she was a younger student and Harry didn't meet her, but in the sense of the story, in the sense of this saga, of this 7-book series, which is one long tale, why at that point in the story is there a character like Luna? And it's interesting to look at that, and I wanted to spend a little time talking about that, how the series develops over these 7 books. And I kind of have my way of looking at it. I know there's a lot of people who love to come up with ways of talking about this. I'm going to give you my take on it. And this has kind of developed over the years of thinking about this. The books do have a natural division to them between the first 4 and the last 3. And of course, there's Quidditch Through the Ages and Fantastic Beasts that come right after book 4. And then there's Tales of Beedle the Bard, which comes after book 7. But kind of looking at the main novels more than anything now. In the first 4, we have a development of a version of Harry. Think about for a minute the fact, well, even just think about the fact that the books 1 through 4 are written in a different style than books 5, 6, and 7. Books 1 through 4 have a lot more whimsy, a lot more, I don't want to say childish, but they have that more of a sense to them. And that's because that's what Harry is. Harry is this little boy. He's 11. And if you're 11 and listening to this and you think, oh, I'm not a little boy, I apologize for that. But he is young. He is looking at this world that he's now suddenly become a part of with this eye of wonder and eye of everything is so wonderful and cool and neat and perfect even at the beginning. He feels like this is the world he wants to be part of. And we talked in the last podcast about prejudice and the rise of prejudice and the way that Harry's view of things changes and has his eyes, in a sense, get opened in a good way in book 1, but also he starts in the books, especially in books 2 and 3 and 4, he starts to really see the dark side of the world that he's become a part of, the prejudice and the way that people treat each other and treat muggles and treat werewolves and hippogriffs and all these kinds of prejudices that come out. But at the same time, Harry, in books 1 through 4, is turning into, and I like to call him action figure Harry. He is in Goblet of Fire. He's kind of come to fruition as this hero. He can fly better than anybody. He can fight dragons. He has, especially in book 3, really learned how wonderful his family was, and the fact that he comes from this perfect mom and dad who were these wonderful people and everybody loved them. And he is a champion, and he overcomes that even the prejudice against him. He gets over that. Everybody cheers for him there. He finally keenly develops his ability to be the one who saves everybody. He's a hero, and His friends help him, of course, but he is the one. He is the only Triwizard Champion. Even with the help of various other people who help him out, he is the champion. And what happens through that is he becomes this person, this hero, this person who maybe, just maybe, is going to be able to defeat Voldemort. He is going to have the skills and the power as a wizard to be able to defeat the evil dark wizard. And then we have this gap, which was the gap in the writing as well, and then we get to book five. And I don't know about everybody else, but when you first read book five, wasn't there this feeling of, where in the world am I now? This isn't my Harry Potter. What happened to this character? Because he's undergoing this massive transformation. And what happens in book five, what happens is all of these things which made him the hero that he thought he was going to be, that we all thought he was going to be in book four, all of these things get stripped away one by one in book five. His broom gets taken away. He can't fly anymore. His image of his parents as being these wonderful, perfect people gets dashed when he sees that memory of Snape being tormented by his father. His relationship with Dumbledore. Dumbledore is becoming this person who is his mentor, but in book five, Dumbledore won't even look at him. All of these things in book five, his fame, his sanity, everything about him is ripped away. And then at the end, even his saving people thing, as Hermione puts it, his I'm the hero stuff gets totally destroyed when his saving people thing results in the death of Sirius. And so Harry, at the end, there's even a line where he says, this is when he's in Dumbledore's office, just raging, which, again, they didn't put this in the film because they missed the point that this was the point of the book. Harry is raging, and the sentence is there, he doesn't want to be Harry anymore. And that is so telling, because that is this point where everything he became in book four is thrown out the window. Everything he became, or thought he was going to become, or thought he had to be, in order to defeat Voldemort, is destroyed. And here he is at the end of book five, and all of his worldview is shattered. And now, why is Luna there? Because all through, and you do catch glimpses of this in the film, not nearly because we miss so much of that final speech, but Luna becomes this figure who shows him that there's a different way to look at the world, that there is a different path, there is a different outlook, that you don't, in a sense, fight against death, because that's what he was going to do. He was going to be, in a sense, the good version of Voldemort, fighting against death in book four. In book five, he walks through that dark place, and he comes out, and Sirius is dead, and he's frantically casting about trying to find a way to contact Sirius to still beat death. And Luna just kind of smiles at him and says, but it's not like we'll never see them again. And all of a sudden, she is the one who opens his eyes to the fact that there is more to life and more to death than what he was thinking, what we were all thinking. Going all the way back to book one, when Dumbledore says that death is the next great adventure. Dumbledore gets it from book one. He has now guided Harry not to become the superhero Harry, the action figure Harry. He is guiding Harry to become this new Harry, the one who can see that the way to defeat the dark side is not to defeat death. The way to defeat the dark side is to see the world in a new way. And it's interesting that the first time Harry is really happy since the beginning of book three, when he has 3 weeks on his own in Diagon Alley, the next time that Harry is really happy is in book six, when he finally kind of comes into his own, not as a superhero, but as a person who is part of this larger story of the world of Hogwarts. He and Jenny. All of the things which can truly make someone happy starts to happen for him in book six. And that is the point where Dumbledore can leave him. And so in story terms, again, we're stepping out of the story here, in story terms, it wasn't until then that that in the story that wise mentor could leave and could be gone and could bring us to the point where he is ready to for book seven, which again is a totally different book. We have a book where he learns that last lesson, which is, no, Harry, you cannot do this alone. You are not the hero. You are one part of the team, of the group that is going to make this happen. I mean, it's very telling, the fact that of all the Horcruxes, Harry only destroys one. And that's on in book two. After that, every Horcrux is destroyed by someone else. He is not the hero. He is not, well, he is, but he's not the action figure hero who, with everybody else standing back and going, oh, Harry, he does all this on his own. It isn't that way. He is not one. He is part of the group, the team, the family, if you will, the group bound by love and by affection and by support. This group, which is going to, together with all of their contributions, be able to defeat Voldemort in the end. And that is, I think, such an exciting, fun way to look at the series. And then when you read the books, you read book two. And you're reading book two, and a lot of people have told me, oh, I don't care that much for book two. Or book five, I just didn't like book five. And you think, okay, I understand, but take it when you read that book as being part of the whole story. Look at what's happening to Harry here. How are we seeing the development of Harry? Is it action figure Harry, or is it friendship and love beats all, the group Harry at the end, who can, along with everyone else, defeat Voldemort? And when you read book five, remember that you're seeing an important development in this character. Watch as his life is redirected into the place where it's supposed to go. Fascinating way to read the books, and it makes it so much fun to read the books again, because you can kind of put that into your mind, that filter, as you read through, and you'll see all new details, things you never noticed before, phrases that never jumped out for you. Things which you thought were just a fun line, like the death is just another, it's just the next great adventure, that's a great line. But it's a great line when you tie it in with what Harry learns in book five and book six. So just again, the wonderful series of books that we have, the creative effort on Rowling's part extends far beyond cleverly using bits of folklore or inventing really cool characters. It also has that next level of depth and of richness, which is, I think, one more reason why we all love these books so much. And I have to say, one of the reasons why the films, no matter how much I love them and no matter how excited I get about them and love everything about them, are just slightly disappointing. Because they miss, in so many ways, the point of all of this development. And in a sense, how could they not? They didn't have the complete plan when they were doing it. But for example, you know, why did we miss so much of the backstory in book three, when that was the whole point of book three, was the backstory? Why did we miss the so much of the, I mean, the anger of and the frustration of Harry in book five was thrown in there a little bit, but it wasn't the point of the book, of the movie. Well, it can't be. They've got to tell a story, and they've got to have the wonderful special effects and things. True, but really, that is the point that's supposed to come out. That is the point of that book. And at the end, when Harry stands there facing Voldemort, and is in the book, when he casts that Expelliarmus, when he offers Voldemort the opportunity for remorse. And if you haven't read the books yet, oh, you have to read the final confrontation in that light, understanding where Harry is coming from, because we're seeing that new Harry facing Voldemort. And you remember shortly before that, and I say shortly in, you know, days, weeks, whatever, in the story, but he realizes, and this is after the death of Dobby, that he realizes that his connection with Voldemort has taken a different tone. He has control of it now. That's that last piece of being able to control that connection between him and Voldemort. And that again comes in. He's facing Voldemort, and Voldemort has no control over him anymore. And he is just talking with him, and still offers him the opportunity, that last opportunity for remorse, that he still could have that chance. And what eventually defeats Voldemort is an Expelliarmus spell, a spell of disarming, a spell of not of anger, not of fighting, which again, we see Expelliarmus used in the books almost as a weapon, but it's not. It's a defense. It is a, I'm going to stop us from fighting. I'm going to take away the fight here. That's what Harry uses. And it works, of course, and how and why and all this stuff. But, and by the way, do you know where Harry learned the Expelliarmus spell? Book 2, from Snape. So interesting again. And some of you, if we've had conversations or if you heard my talks, I often talk about the fact that the Harry Potter series is really, truly the story of Snape told through Harry's eyes. So next time when you start picking up the book and you say, okay, I'm gonna read through the series again, or I'm going to listen through it again, or I'm going to pick up book 3 again, get in your mind before you start reading it, okay, what is book 3? Book 3 is not just a ripping good tale, because it really is. It's not just a really good movie, because it is that too, but what it really is Harry's view of the world being developed, his view of the past being developed, his view of the people in his past being developed, his sense of being part of a larger tapestry of history, if you will, being developed. And so read book 3 to make sure that you stay grounded in that story, so when you enjoy the film, you can enjoy the film for what it is, but have that behind you in your mind, so you seeing those pieces of the film in that larger context. And that makes the film, all of the films, so much more interesting if you can see them in that light. So just a wonderful, wonderful way to look at the books, at the Harry Potter canon, at what Rowling has developed. By all means, if you've got thoughts on that, send me an email or post. Or even better, why don't you post on the Facebook page? Because there is a Facebook page, a fan page, where you can post and we can kind of get a conversation going. That's even better than email, because then everybody can kind of be part of it. If you want to follow on Twitter, lexicon_Steve is my Twitter, and I'm putting some trivia on there. So as I mentioned before, I'm reading Chamber of Secrets now, so I keep putting in Chamber of Secrets trivia up there. But it would be great to have people on the fan page, just kind of getting some conversation going about some of these things. I would love that opportunity. I've also finally posted something on the What's New on the Lexicon itself. People have been asking why I didn't. Well, I didn't, because I just I just kept editing, and all the edits seem kind of small and not kind of worthy of a big fancy What's New post. But I did post something on there. I'm going to try to start using that a little bit more as a blog, with some in-depth discussion about things. So, and there's also, of course, on the Lexicon, there's a link for the podcast up at the top. You'll see a podcast link. Click on that, and you go to get to the show notes. So that's worth doing. I think that about wraps things up for episode 5. I want to make sure I thank Harry and the Potters one more time for giving me permission to use that music, and I think we'll let them apparate us out of here. This is Steve Vander Ark for the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast, and as always, thanks for listening.